Huff is used to be the Speaker of the House in Colorado, and he's sort of a mainstream liberal. And Kaufman is a former Marine who is a conservative Republican who is very big on cutting money on the Defense Department, though.
We have to leave it there. We want to thank you very much for being with us, Mike Litwin, with the Colorado Independent, former veteran reporter with the Denver Post. And that does it for our show. Happy birthday to Jamie Hill. Special thanks today to Dennis Moynihan. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Dina Guzder. And special thanks to Denver Open Media, Tony Shawcross, and Ann Tice, and all the folks here that made this broadcast possible. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is WHFR Dearborn, and now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. There we go. Hi, everybody. This is Jay Koronek here at WHFR. We're off to a little uncertain start, but that's because we're also excited here. We've got a great show for you today, as every Friday, of course. And it's all about some of the local issues and candidates that are on the ballot on the November 4th election. And definitely, you need to know. And so we'd like to provide, you know, information that you can't get anywhere else, and in sometimes a more direct manner, directly from the candidates or the people involved with millage proposals. And of course, that's why today we're having a report from the Dearborn Public Schools. Superintendent Brian Winston was scheduled. He might still show up, but he is at a school doing his job somewhere where they need him today. And so Dave Mustonen, their public information officer, if I have that right, Dave, public sure. information, of course. Yeah.
Of course.
Okay. Because it's for everybody to know. And so he's with us to fill in the gaps of any of your questions. We'll try to cover quite a few, of course. And we don't take phone calls because we don't have any extra people here. John Conroy is with me, co-host, WHFR news director. But he's busy, too, figuring out his questions when I give him a second to jump in. So hi, John.
Hello, Jay.
See, your mic works. That's good.
That's a good thing.
Okay. This is a renewal, Dave. We're going to get right into it here. Dave Mustonen speaking for the Dearborn Public Schools. And this particular one only comes up every 10 years, and the basic catchphrase is calling it a hold harmless millage. And tell us how that actually started and what it's all about, and why, of course, we'll get into why it's important.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Jay. I appreciate time to be on the show and have a little opportunity to talk about this. You know, really, we got to step back 20 years in time. So, you know, put on that time machine, step back a little bit, think about it. You know, we were watching Forrest Gump in the theaters. We were watching Friends, Jennifer Aniston on TV and 20 years ago. And we also in Michigan, we changed a couple things. We passed Proposal A, and one of the things that Proposal A did was it changed the way that schools were funded. Prior to Proposal A, taxes collected locally stayed locally in your district. And what was good, that was good for us here in Dearborn. We have a large home base. We have a large business base. And so we were able to fund our schools quite well here in Dearborn. But in other districts across the state, there didn't have quite as big of a tax base. So there was a real disparity in funding. So once Proposal A was passed, what happened was taxes collected locally were sent to Lansing and then distributed back to every school district on a per student basis. And this really, it really did help a lot of students across the state. The problem that it caused here in Dearborn was that the amount of funding we received prior to Proposal A was actually more than what we would get after Proposal A. And so this new funding method was going to harm us here in Dearborn. And so the state said, well, you can go to your voters and you can ask them to pass a millage that would make up that difference between the old funding system and the new funding system. And that way you will be held harmless against this new funding system. The only thing is that every 10 years you have to go to the voters and ask them to approve that millage again. And that's exactly what we did back in 1994, and the voters did pass the Hold Harmless millage. And then in 2004, we went back to the voters, and once again, they very graciously said yes. And so here we are 10 years later asking, and as I always say, in 10 more years, we'll be here again, and hopefully I'll be on my last year and getting ready to retire. But I may have actually one more of these to do, which is fine. But right now, here we are in 2014 asking our voters to once again renew this current millage.
Well, we've been joined in the studio by the superintendent himself, as advertised on our webpage. Brian Whiston, welcome again to the new WHFR Journal.
Thank you for having us. Just, we appreciate the opportunity.
Keeping busy with all the schools in Dearborn?
Yes, that's enough to keep us busy, but a lot of exciting things going on, so it's a good thing.
I remember in the millage campaign in the fall that there was a summary of how many buildings, how many people we actually have in the Dearborn Public Schools district, and it's a major enterprise. It's how many buildings is it? It's 100, is it over 100?
32 buildings.
32.
32 buildings.
Well, something was more than 100.
Yeah. Well, certainly we have 19,000, over 600 kids, and we're the third largest school district in the state, some 2,400 employees. Right. And so, yeah, it is a major enterprise. The total operational budget of $180 million. Throw in special ed and title funding, we're over $200 million. And so that's a very large corporation. And many districts, the school district's the largest employer in the community. Of course, we have Ford Motor Company, so I don't think I can beat that.
But you and the rest of the administrators, we have a relatively lean administrative team, if I may say so, and from my observation from the outside. And so you're very busy going around to the different schools, the school districts. Of course, you're, along with Dave, a primary spokesperson, especially at times like these, which just like last fall that we saw you in here talking about the other millage, which is a different part of supporting millage. But let me talk about Hold Harmless. Dave gave us the background, the history on that. And, you know, I remember when it started, it really did bring a lot of districts in Michigan up to this new state parity for funding. But it did cut, say, 50 or 60 districts unless they voted in millages like this upcoming one to continue the same amount of additional support. So it's not an increase in terms of what people have already been paying even before Proposal A, in a way, because it's just sort of trying to keep parity with what we needed for our operation, which is a very, very full program. I think very appropriate to have a full program of a lot of aspects, whether it's even the basics of science and math can be taught better and more effectively with more equipment and more facilities. But you know, I can't imagine how some of the districts are getting by without that. They really must be relatively bare bones, but that would be would certainly hurt us. This is 22% of our budget, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, you're ahead of, you know, with Proposal A, certainly it's done a lot of great things. It did reduce taxes here in Dearborn. It did reduce the disparity of funding among school districts around the state. So Proposal A has done a lot of good things. One component of Proposal A is that every 10 years we have to keep coming back and asking voters to renew this millage. As David said, it's a renewal, not a tax increase. But if you were to go back to the time of Proposal A, this actually is a tax cut. I mean, the taxpayers here did receive a nice tax cut, but that was 20 years ago, and none of us are going to remember that. But with this proposal, it is very important to renew it. If we were to lose this $40 million it would be devastating. I was talking to the previous superintendent who told me his budget was around $220 million. Mine's $180 million. I have 1,000 more students than he had. So you can see we've already been cut significantly in our funding. And so to take another cut would be devastating. There's a lot of great things going on in Dearborn schools. The quality of the school districts directly impacts home ownership and the ability to have your home values continue to grow. And in Dearborn, because of the great things going on in the school district and the community, our home values are maintaining and growing. And so certainly our taxpayers are getting a great benefit from the schools.
Let me bring up the point, and I'm not trying to get political here, because I know it is a question in the gubernatorial race, and that is, has the school budget been cut or increased? And I guess it all depends on what numbers you look at. Obviously, in Dearborn, from what you just said, we are funding our operation, even with 19,000 students, at a lot less money than we had before. So that state equated amount, that changes. Depends on politics. The legislature decides how much that Proposal A money of funding for each school district is going to be each year.
Right. Yeah, certainly both sides in the governor's race are accurate. The governor has put more money into education, but most of that has gone in to help our retirement system, which we're very grateful for, and we needed that. But in terms of the operations, we lost $5 million in at-risk funding, which is about $280 a kid at the time. We lost $470 in a foundation cut, and our cost in terms of retirement and health care are going up. So has the legislature and the governor put more money into education? Absolutely, yes. But has our budgets been cut? Absolutely, yes. We are living with less money today than we had, say, 4 years ago.
Yeah, especially for classroom instruction. And I remember somewhere about the retirement monies, and I don't know the exact words. Yes, the governor helped by funding that amount. But at one point, I heard someone say, but the state is really required to do that funding anyway. Is it either or? I mean, someone said if the state doesn't do it, then the local district has to do it. But I don't think there's many local districts that have the money to do that.
Right. Certainly what the governor and legislature deserve credit for reforms in the retirement system that have reduced the burden on the retirement system, and they have given us money to help pay our share, but about 28 cents out of every payroll dollar we have to send to the state to pay for the retiree health care and retiree benefits. And it is a state benefit. It's not something we negotiated at the local level and therefore should be responsible for the cost. These are state benefits. All teachers, all administrators get the same benefits. It's a state benefit when we on retirement. So those costs are going up. The legislature has done some things to help reduce those costs. They have put money in to help protect our pension plan. So yes, more money has gone into the retirement. And yes, our school budgets have been cut because of the operational funds that have been cut.
Well, that's a pretty clear statement then. And it is up to all of the voters. And we hope that's everybody that's registered in Dearborn, because our kids are our future. Our kids are our community today. The Dearborn Public Schools is not asking for, and this is not an endorsement, I'm just saying the facts here. They're asking for a renewal of this particular package. And it's actually just one ballot proposal, yes or no, but it includes 18 mills, which is paid by business and commercial property, and 6.17 mills, about one-third as much, which is on homeowners. So, but it's just one vote you make, yes or no.
That's correct.
Okay. Okay, so that's going to be there November 4th, folks, and try to get all the facts and make the best decision that you want to. The only argument against it is, of course, and I hate to bring this up, but in all fairness, you don't have the money individually. Well, but can the community survive without our kids? And obviously, one of the number one, I think, correlations to property values, if you're concerned about that, if people want to buy a home in this area, if you want to resell your home, how good are the schools? Dearborn has a good reputation, very good, in fact. And that's one of the reasons that Dearborn is a good place to live, and one of the reasons our property values are higher than Detroit, among many other reasons. So this, even for the people that say, well, I don't have the money, it's not that much more, especially in this case. Is it two-thirds or three-quarters? I can't remember my math, but most of this millage has to be paid, if passed, by business and commercial property owners, which they're used to. They've budgeted for this before, but nobody likes to pay money out if they don't have to. But there's some things you really need, almost like public utilities. You got to pay for the water and the, well, that's debatable, I guess, to put it according to the United Nations. Yeah. But water is a right. Yeah. Okay. but that's not the case for judges in Detroit. They say you got to pay for water if you want it. They're working out some great deals. And unfortunately, we don't work out any great deals. The payment plan is the millage. And when you pay your property taxes, or these millage taxes, and they come, is that the amount that I pay in the fall and then in the winter? Or is that city taxes? Or these, how are these paid? I can't remember how I pay them now.
Well,
isn't that terrible?
In Dearborn, I get two different bills. I get one, you know, that came in September.
Right.
And then one that comes in like February
or
March.
That's the one. Yeah, yeah. Those are the two. Right. I think to get the message out, I should say, of course, Dearborn Schools website, which is dearbornschools.org.
Yep, that'll work.
That's got all the information there, tons of information. There's been at least two mailings that you folks have sent, very clear, well-worded. I guess that's up to you, Dave. Congratulations.
That's part of the job. Thank you.
And beautiful graphics, very colorful. I was thinking of putting it up as a fall decoration on my door. It's so cute, all those kids dancing in a line there.
Orange
but seriously,
colors.
The information is there, folks. If you have any questions about it, of course, they'll take your phone calls. It says you can even call, the main office. Or
call David or
I.
827-3006.
That'll get right into our office.
827-3006. And there's another public meeting where people can talk about any ins or outs of this that they'd like to, at least yourself and maybe Dave too will be at. And where's that going to be? It's going to be this coming Monday, the 10th?
Monday the 20th.
20th. Monday the 20th. 3 and 17 makes 20.
That's right. Monday the 20th at 7 p.m. in the boardroom at our administration building, 18700 Audette. We will be there to give our presentation and give the information and to answer any questions that you may have about the Hold Harmless Millage and share some information about our district as well. So we encourage everybody to attend that meeting. Mm-hmm. Very informative.
That building, didn't it used to be called, or is it still called the Tonight Building?
Yep. Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
If people are old enough to remember, now it's totally just administrative.
That's correct. Right?
Yeah,
that's
so,
correct.
Okay.
Yep.
And if I can ask you here, just to follow up, our next guest is in the wings, as they say, the green room. Is it green out there? Well, almost. So we got to move on. But one of the big questions that I can't remember now. Oh, don't worry about it. it was something. Oh yeah. Have you fixed the roof in the Tenike building? That was one of the issues. You know, Mayor O'Reilly offered about a year and a half ago to share the administrative services building that is the new City Hall, de facto now in Michigan Avenue, and they still have a whole second floor waiting for you, you know.
Well,
have you repaired the things needed at least to get by in Tenike? Is that the situation?
Well,
right now
I think
there?
The board is going to be looking at that in the near future. We're certainly in conversations with the college to see if there's any opportunity to do a shared administrative, if there's room over here as an option, or fixing the Tenike building is another option.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll look at those two options.
Love to have you. It's a shorter walk to get to WHFR if you move in over here.
That's right.
But crossing Michigan Avenue from the Dearborn Administrative Services, that's a killer. Careful. That's rough.
That.
I know that as a bicyclist, it's not easy to do. Well, it's been great fun, but it's very, very important, folks. It's the Hold Harmless Millage Renewal Proposal that's on the ballot on November 4th here in Dearborn. So please vote. Vote your conscience, and I hope you have one. This is really important, 22% of the budget to keep our schools going. And I think it's very important for you to get out there and state your preference, as well as all the other races, too. So got to close this segment, but thank you for coming by, folks, and back to work, right?
Thank you, Jay.
Thanks
appreciate it. Yeah, appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. Well,
thank you.
Good luck with getting your message out. All right. We're going to put an announcement up here and commentary from Jack Lesenberry right now about the gubernatorial election, and we'll be back with our next guest.
Almost 2 years ago, I spoke to a group called CRAM, the County Road Association of Michigan. These are the folks who maintain Michigan streets and highways, both urban and rural. I found these folks mainly had frustrating professional lives, trying to do too much with too few resources, being blamed for problems they weren't being given enough money to fix. Yesterday, however, some pundits may have been startled when their political action group, Rush Pack, announced it was endorsing Governor Rick Snyder for re-election. That may surprise some because, although the governor did announce a plan to raise revenue for the roads, he's failed to get it through the legislature. Second, Rush Pack doesn't normally endorse anybody in governor's races, not even when John Engler ran against Jeffrey Figer. Nobody can remember the last time they backed a candidate. But I wasn't the least bit surprised by this. RUSH, by the way, stands for Rural and Urban Streets and Highways. The one thing all those roads have in common is that they're in bad shape and getting worse. 2 years ago, Snyder proposed a plan to raise $1.2 billion in new revenue a year for the roads. He would have raised the gas tax and also increased the amount we pay in car and truck registration fees. You could quibble with his exact formula. I thought he needed to raise the fees far more on the huge tractor trailers that do the most to tear up our roads, for example. But it was a plan, the numbers added up, and it would have produced enough money to get the job done. Not, sadly, enough anymore. The amount our roads now need to get them back up to par is more than $2 billion a year, highway experts tell me. The legislature, sadly, did nothing. It is perfectly legitimate to criticize the governor's leadership skills, though in this era of tea parties and term limits, persuading Republicans to raise taxes is something like herding feral cats to march in a parade. You might think this would be a golden opportunity for Mark Schauer, the Democratic nominee, except he's booted it big time. Schauer hasn't presented any rational plan to fix the roads. This summer, he told me he intended to come up with much of the money by eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse in state government, which is sort of like saying you plan to buy a new car with a loose change you dig out of the sofa cushions. Schauer also said he'd ask the federal government for the money. He might be better off asking Santa Claus. He's also hinted at getting the businesses who got the big tax cuts to pay for the roads. None of these ideas is realistic in the least. Mark Schauer must know that. He knows he'd have to raise taxes to fix them, but is afraid of alienating any voters by saying exactly how. That's not leadership. Yesterday, Denise Donahue of Rush Pack said that while Snyder may not have gotten the job done, he has demonstrated leadership on this issue for the last 2 years. Schauer hasn't. If the governor is indeed reelected 19 days from now, this may be a big part of the reason why.
This is the new WHFR Journal. Jay Koronek here with you and John Conroy. And we're very happy to welcome to the studio another candidate for the 12th District U.S. Congress seat from Michigan. And welcome to Debbie Dingell. How are you, Debbie?
It's great to be with both of you. I'm doing great. I just want to know how winter all of a sudden started to come.
Yeah, it probably wasn't quite so bad campaigning when the weather was nice and warm and sunny, a little chill in the air, but now it's getting even chillier and rain and all that. You've been, of course, part of many, many political campaigns since you've been, and probably even before, you were married to John Dingell. That's how you got the last name, of course. And that was 1981,
I believe. That's correct.
So all those campaigns that he was successful with, even before 81, I think he was, didn't he take office after his father, and that was 1948, perhaps?
No, it
somewhere
was
around
1955.
There? 55, okay, close enough, I guess. All right. And what a wonderful career, and obviously the support from this area to reelect him in these many, many times. And it's amazing that for Congress, it's every 2 years. Wow.
But, you know, I think that 2 years is good because I think that it keeps an elected representative being a representative of the people. It keeps you involved in the community, and I think it's the greatest form of democracy that there is. When people say that we should have term limits, I think you don't need term limits. I think you have an election, and people need to be involved and engaged, and if they believe the person representing them is doing a good job, reelect them, and if they want change, vote for change.
But all those chicken dinners, I mean, the fundraising part, that's got to be rough. And you go to many of them, and do you maybe not eat them that much if you're concerned about your health? You know, I'm just saying.
I think the fundraising is the worst part of this this whole process. And I think that, you know, when we're at the end of this year's election in Michigan, it will clearly have been a $100 million race in just the state of Michigan. And yesterday, Secretary Clinton was in town and I'm still one of the people that is not quite sure whether she's made a decision to run again. I clearly will support her if she does. But for if she decides to run, that she will have to raise $1.4 billion. I want you all to think about how much money that is and how frightening that is and how terrifying. Well, and what the Supreme Court, Citizens United, the amount of money that people can pour into these campaigns without any accountability, it's just awful.
That was one of the topics I was going to ask you about, although I think I made a list of 16 or 17. There's so many topics at the national level, things that haven't been done yet. And, of course, that was one of them, campaign financing. The Citizens United ruling, that has to be either, I don't know, some ruling by the Supreme Court to undo it, or what would it take? A passage of a law in Congress or an amendment to the Constitution?
Probably both. I think you we need to see something passed in the Congress, but I think ultimately it could take a constitutional amendment to try to because, I mean, the Supreme Court ruled that it is freedom of speech, but it's freedom of speech for a very small minority of people that have that kind of money that they can spend,
and
there's no balance on the other side.
I think a lot of us, maybe we're somewhat simple-minded on this issue, but corporations are not people.
You will find me agreeing with you.
You know, there's rich people at the top. If they want to spend their money, fine. But the corporations themselves don't have freedom of speech, but the people do. And, when the people at the top speak for the corporation, that doesn't represent the people that work for them. And that's not fair. So there's a democratic representation issue there somewhere. So obviously you would be against it. What about PAC funds? Those were a scandal even before Citizens United. I don't know what the PAC stands for, but I know that it's almost unlimited funding, and a lot of times they don't have to report who's giving it.
Actually, that I will disagree with you. There's two different kinds of money. A PAC is a political action committee, and many different organizations have what you call a PAC. So you have consumer groups, you have environmental groups, you have corporations that have what they will call a political action committee, where a group of people come together that agree or are like-minded on an issue. There are strong legal limits on the amount of money that a PAC may give to a campaign.
Super PAC. Is that the other one?
Super PAC is what you are the thinking negatives. Of. That's where you're thinking of. So the PAC. So like right now in the law, a candidate can take, I think it's $5,000 in a general or primary election each from a PAC, and all that money must be reported. The super PACs do not require reporting and do have unlimited amounts of money. That's where the difference is, and that comes from the Citizens United Supreme Court case.
It may not matter. I'll try and make this brief. As a college professor here in telecommunication for 40 years before I retired to just sit in this comfortable chair, most of that money has to go to television and some of it to radio advertising, media advertising. And the political commercials, at least according to the so-called Truth Squad working out of Bridge Magazine, the Center for Michigan in Ann Arbor, almost all of them are doing negative campaigning, not talking so much about themselves, but about what they see as what's wrong with the other candidate. And that's just, I know it works. I know it sort of works for those short 30-second spots. But it's not very informative, and the Truth Squad has said it looks like almost each side, Democrats, Republicans, there's almost no advertising commercially from third-party groups, either fouls, flagrant fouls, or just, warnings, that's the least, but all of us who are telecom professors, we know you can't make a good case, a good argument. You can't give fair, objective facts in 30 seconds. You just can't. And it's been a proposal among us, a small group of people in the whole United States, because of this research, political campaign ads should be banned. Now, that's really radical and probably will never get passed because the people in Congress got elected that way by using them. But, longer debates, even this discussion here,
Well, I would actually. Well,
it was much
clearly
better.
Clearly, discussions are a much better process, and people hearing where you stand. And, you know, I've been doing a series of house parties across the district. I said at the beginning, if I could do 500 of them, I'd be happy. I haven't gotten near that. It may have been ambitious, but I'm going to keep doing them after the election, too, because you get to meet people. I think you're never going to ban political advertisement. You talk about the Supreme Court and freedom of speech.
Yeah,
that would
I know,
be a major violation in terms of what people thought about the freedom of speech. But and I would also say to you that most of the ads that are being played in Michigan are actually not by the candidates themselves, but have been by third-party people, starting with the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. The Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee have been one of the third-party players, but the Koch brothers have been one, have I think singularly been the largest buyer of ads in the state of Michigan in this cycle, though you've seen many other third-party groups that have bought these ads. I have said to people for years, I hate negative ads. Why do we have to do negative ads? And the reality of the matter is that negative ads work. And everybody says that they hate them, but if you want to win a race and you're in a tough competitive race, I'm grateful that I'm not, that I had the luxury of defining myself with positive cable ads. You don't have any choice because the people that are in tight races end up going negative because that's the way that they win. And the only way you're ever going to change it is if the American people say we don't like it, but the American people don't then really vote that way. They don't react to people being negative. They are influenced by these negative ads, and that's how people win. And there is something wrong with it. I want people like you to keep fighting it.
Well, however we can. You know, I in a way, I don't think I'm against negative advertising, even if it's only 30 seconds and a soundbite. You can't really judge too much of the background rationale for it. But if it was fair, if it was true, you know, if it was really true, provable true, that the other candidate did something that is not positive, either towards their candidacy or in their personal life, perhaps, if you have to go that far, that might relate to their judgments in Congress, then okay. But, you know, when the Truth Squad gets going here, and it seems consistently there's exaggerations, slanting, which you could say is either fair or not fair to a certain extent, and then there's factual errors. Or we just had the superintendent of public schools on here, and you met him on the way out here in Dearborn, Brian Whiston, and he had to clarify again. Why does Governor Snyder say he increased the money to schools? Why does Mark Schauer say the schools are operating with less money? And they're both kind of right, but what matters to the kids, according to the superintendent, is what Mark Schauer has been saying, and that is that they're not effectively getting money in the classroom to equal what it even was. Well, we got to move on, but we're talking to Debbie Dingell here, a candidate for 12th District, going to the U.S. Congress. Yes, her husband, John Dingell, was in office since 1955. Yeah, and she is going to try to take the seat. I have to ask at the outset, and you've been asked this before, maybe you can jump us into some other topics here that you believe in and really want to support strongly if you're elected. How different will you be from John Dingell?
Well, John and I have, our values are the same. I am very much my own person. I was my own person before I married John Dingell. I just will say for the record, until I met John Dingell, I was a Republican. You are correct that I had been involved in other things, but I tell people I was a Milliken Republican and I'm a Dingell Democrat. And I do believe people should know where they stand on issues and be passionate on issues. And that's how I became involved in politics, was being passionate about some issues. As a young person that I was very interested in. John, we both care about health care very deeply, but I founded something called the National Women's Health Resource Center when a friend was very ill and there was no information that women were not being included in federally funded health research, that any federally funded health research did not include women because we had hormones. And so the Framingham study, which was the study in heart disease that said an aspirin a day keeps the doctor away, had no women in it. In those days, the insurance companies for the auto companies didn't include mammograms as part of their coverage. There was no work being done on breast cancer. There are a number of things. That is one of my passions in terms of just working to make sure we're getting answers to women's health issues. We have very different styles. I am not going to try to beat John Dingell because I cannot beat John Dingell. I know how big his shoes are, and they're impossible to fill. Before I ever met John, I had my own career. I've been involved and engaged and worked on multiple projects in the southeastern Michigan region. I've been known for trying to bring together people of disparate backgrounds and different opinions to find common ground. That's who I'm going to be.
Yeah, we didn't begin, as we usually do, to allow you time to talk about your bio, that is your background and experience. But besides the educational background you have, which is you have a master's degree.
I do.
Georgetown University. But
correct.
Before that,
Georgetown as
also,
well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's it's always nice to have people who are educated formally in office, but also years of public service in so many charities and other organizations. I guess briefly, was it when you met John or before? Of course, your family has been, by heritage, connected to General Motors Corporation. And you were a lobbyist for a while in your early days, no?
When I was young, before I met John, I was a researcher in the GM Washington office, and I did, but I was not a lobbyist from the time that I married John. I was lucky to work. I did work for General Motors for more than 30 years. I was lucky to work for a corporation that was large enough that gave me a variety of different experiences. I did business planning, which, quite frankly, and strategic planning, I think is going to turn out to be very useful in the next steps of my life, because I think we do need to take principles of business and learn to balance budgets and need to think about a number of those serious issues. I was president of the GM Foundation and engaged in many important projects in southeastern Michigan. So that was a very important part of my career. Then when I left General Motors, because at the point at which the companies went into this crisis, I just felt that I needed to move on. I worked for the three domestic autos on a manufacturing project, chairing a project, because I think manufacturing is absolutely critical in this country, and we need to bring it back to this country. We need to have a manufacturing base. We need to create jobs, and I worked very hard on that. And then the most recent project before I did this was to also bring 10,000 small businesses to southeastern Michigan.
Hmm. Wow. That's a lot of small businesses. Where did you find them? Other states?
Well, I didn't bring 10,000. It's a project. It's something called 10,000 Small Businesses.
Right. Okay.
Do you remember that Morning Joe was here? I was very about three weeks ago at Wayne State. Mm-hmm. I brought it to Wayne State University, and it is a program that brings capital, but it also trains small business owners who are ready to take their business to the next level. And they've got the top Babson College from the Massachusetts has developed an entrepreneur curriculum, which gives small business owners the tools that they need to manage the business and take it to the next level. And then there's also capital, which they need to go and apply for, which would be available to help them take their businesses to the next level.
I suspect you're not supportive of right to work and the Governor Snyder's initiative to effectively cut the business tax a few years ago. Not too much. He streamlined it a little bit, but he did cut it, and there was a lot of revenue lost, and a lot of that came from education and elsewhere in Michigan. Your Republican opponent was here on September 19th. We have podcast that show too, folks. You can listen, WHFR.FM. And he is apparently a national speaker on national right to work, which is such a misnomer. There's so many things that I think should be repealed. But people say, oh, but it sounds so lovely. Yeah, from the three or four words he used to describe it. But I've heard right to work also called right to work for less, too.
That is my favorite phrase. It is right to work for less. You asked me about 100 questions inside of there, and I want to talk about all of those subjects. But let's talk about, I think the thing that disappoints me the most for that the governor has done in the last 4 years was the support of Right to Work, because I think that this is a state that business and labor are working together to create a competitive environment, and that people forget that when or don't recognize that those that are represented by labor make a higher income, and that all working men and women benefit from representation by a labor union that fights for them. We have a 40-hour work week. We have vacations. We have benefits. When you're in the classroom, the size of that classroom, the student-teacher ratio is negotiated by the student union, as you know, having been here at this university. When you're in the hospital, the number of patients that a nurse takes care of is, again, protected in many hospitals by the unions. And I could go on with a litany of lists about why what they do is important. So, I think that business and labor need to work together in this state, because I think people look at Michigan and call it, oh, that's a union state, that's a place not to do business. Well, that's here's crazy. A story that I'm going to tell you. It is crazy.
Yeah.
You know, Jeffrey Immelt brought GE to this state a couple of years ago, probably because President Obama urged him to do that. But when he got here, the skilled workforce that he found is one he talks about across these United States. And GE has brought more jobs to the state because he believes that this is a state that is, it is a state that's got the workforce that he needs to do the business that they need to try to do. I think that it's important to have a competitive environment for businesses to come here. You need to have a competitive business climate. You need to watch what your taxes are. You're competing with other states, but you need to have a fair and balanced tax system that does not place an unfair tax burden on the working men and women while giving those that are better off tax breaks, or having them pay less, or that we're paying corporations who move jobs overseas, that we're giving them tax breaks. That I do not agree with.
I have to say that I come from a worker's background. My father worked at Chrysler Corporation all of his life on the assembly line for almost 50 years. And, I saw in the 1950s the organizing and the support that UAW gave to my father. And I read about the history of the formation of unions and saw how effective they were. And actually, I think they're essential to a good democracy. You talk about the workers and the employers working together. How can the workers work together if they're not organized? I mean, they have to be organized and have representatives that will negotiate for them. They can't just do plebiscites with the workers, you know. It's, you need all those ideas coming in a formal way to the management, and supposedly management would be better for incorporating those ideas and making their workers happy, not just happy, but even more productive. So I see that as required knowledge. Unfortunately, these days, there's not that many people, percentage of the population, that are members of a union. And I don't know how much they talk about unions in the history of America anymore, as if it might be politically incorrect or something. I don't know. I don't know what they're teaching in the high schools, but they should be covering that important part of American history.
I totally agree with you. I think that people are not going to see the impact of Right to Work for a number of years. Therefore, a lot of people don't understand why it is important, why it does matter, that their income and the wages and the benefits they have been gained because they did have somebody representing them. And not only did they have a union, but it was the power of the union. It was the power of bringing everybody together that gives them strength. And I think you already see people making less money now than they used to. We see benefits not... you've seen a significant impact, and I think down the road, a few years from now, you're going to see an even bigger price.
Most of these issues, whether it's taxes on business in Michigan, and of course Right to Work in the state, they're state issues. You're going to represent us in the Congress. And let's just be clear, 12th District, can you even describe what areas that covers today because of gerrymandering. It's really sort of a crazy sort of an L shape, starting from Ann Arbor, swooping through, is it just part of or all of Dearborn? All of Dearborn, and then downriver to maybe as far as Trenton?
I love the 12th District. So I can describe it very well because it's my home. Mm-hmm. And you are correct, it starts in Ann Arbor and has Ipsy and Ipsy Township and then has Belleville and parts of Wayne County. It's, you know, we've lost Inkster and Romulus in the last redistricting 2 years ago, but it does have Dearborn, Allen Park, Lincoln Park, Trenton, Groseal, Flat Rock, here in Township. I'm going to start to get in trouble because I'm not going to name them all because you don't want to hear me do that. But it's the greatest group of people. Mm-hmm. It is a place that you can call home. It's got the beauty of Michigan. You've got true working men and women. It's the backbone of the middle class in this country, and you've got a lot of disparate people, which is what makes it interesting and exciting and a wonderful place to live.
As Stephen Colbert would say, the fighting 12th.
The fighting 12th.
Of course, he calls every district fighting whatever. But
and I think I care to avoid Stephen Colbert as long as I can.
All right. Well, yeah, it looks like his particular persona will be gone in a couple of months, but maybe you'll be invited to the next version of the Letterman Show with the real Stephen Colbert, or he might call himself Colbert then. We're not sure. But supposedly his... he won't be doing satire. We'll have to wait and see, but he might actually be revealing what the satire seems to reveal, which is a very liberal and populist angle. But it's kind of difficult going on the show because you don't know exactly where he's coming from or what jokes to laugh at. We're going to take just a little break here and let Debbie take a sip of beverage. And we're talking to Debbie Dingell, Democrat for the 12th District, representing the 12th District of Michigan to the U.S. Congress. And so, as I said, we'll be back in just a moment. Our break is going to be with Jim Hightower, our friendly national populist, and he's talking about buy local. So more with Debbie Dingell in just 2 minutes.
In case you don't have enough to worry about, consider early mortality syndrome. Sounds gruesomely lethal, doesn't it? Luckily, this is not a human disease, nor has it struck America, but it affects us anyway. EMS is a new bacterial outbreak that's been devastating Thailand's shrimp farming industry. 3 troubling points. Shrimp is by far America's most consumed seafood. The vast majority of it comes from foreign waters, and Thailand supplies most of that. To combat the disease, Thailand shrimp farms have been dumping untold volumes of antibiotics into their ponds. So we're consuming the antibiotics that the imported shrimp consumed. But you might assume that surely our government inspects these boatloads of frozen crustaceans and rejects those too tainted to eat. Well, sort of. Barely. Not really. Remember, corporate lobbyists and screeching anti-government politicos don't like government regulation. So less than 0.5% of the tons of foreign-produced shrimp coming into the U.S. is inspected. Fishier yet, even though our country is blessed to have 3 huge and abundant oceans around us, 90% of the seafood we eat comes from abroad, and less than 2% of that ridiculous volume gets inspected. Indeed, that serving of imported seafood on your plate has traveled an average of 5,475 miles to reach you. And a third of the wild seafood we import has a most unappetizing acronym attached to it, IUU. Or illegal, unreported, and unregulated. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, America's fishing families are being left out and shortchanged in our own market. Just as we've done with beer, books, and broccoli, America needs a locavore seafood movement. For more information, go to Institute for Fisheries Resources at ifrfish.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
So what do you think? Buy local is very important. Sorry, today in 12 minutes, the Dearborn Farmers Market at the Brady Library parking lot, Bryant Library parking lot, is going to be closing for the season. And we don't have any place to do it indoors like Royal Oak does, so we'll wait for them to come back next May of course. And that's a great way to get close to the vendors giving you good, healthy food. But, of course, we have other, like the Dearborn Farmers Market, the indoor location. And, of course, right across the street on Michigan Avenue there, we have the other market, too, whatever. So there's a lot of good boutique markets in Dearborn having local products, but always try to get local. Back to the WHFR Journal, the new WHFR Journal for Friday, October the, what is it, 17th, yep. And we have our special guest here, Debbie Dingell, candidate for 12th District, Democrat for 12th District U.S. Congress. Going to turn over the next segment for a few questions from John Conroy, my colleague. Go, John.
Well, thank you, Jay, and welcome again, Debbie and Zach. I have concerns also, but we'll talk about right now as far as the Middle East is concerned. How are we doing with congressional approval on, as far as the Middle East and the actions that we've been taking over there?
I don't quite know. That's a very broad question.
Yes,
there are, I think all of us want to see peace in the Mideast. And that is a question that is centuries old with many complicated problems. I think the probably what concerns all of us right now is ISIS and the sheer evil that we have seen this summer in the beheading of heads. And I believe that there is no room for anybody to make that issue political. We must all be united in fighting that kind of evil. There are many other complicated issues that you can go through country by country, many being negotiated at the State Department, other issues covered when you talk about what Congress votes for in foreign aid, to may we never, ever have to put boots on the ground again, but we have to fight ISIS in every single way that we can.
And how divided is Congress now, as far as that's concerned?
On fighting ISIS?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that they are united on fighting ISIS. There may be a difference of opinion quite on what the approach is and what the president's authorized to do without congressional approval and what he can do with congressional approval. But I do believe it's not quite like 9/11, but I do believe that we are all united in opposing that kind of horrible, horrible evil.
Well, that's good to hear. On the local level, as far as, and this is close to my home and where you are too, and I also was at one of your home visits and enjoyed that very much, on Gross Hill. The waterways, the Great Lakes and the Detroit River and the lakes surrounding, it appears that there's going to be more and more industrial work coming downriver. How do you think we should protect the waterways from the not only the air pollution but the increased truck traffic, et cetera?
Well, I'm not sure that the truck traffic. First of all, we've got to protect the Great Lakes. We are blessed mm-hmm. with the fresh water that we have. You know, it was funny. I was going through some scrapbooks and found some articles for the 60s when they were writing the original Clean Water Act, which I guess I should say that I'm very proud that John Dingell was one of the original authors of and sponsors of, and that in the 60s, many of the local communities actually had a very negative reaction to efforts to do so because they were concerned about cost. And I don't think people understood how dirty and polluted, or they just didn't see it. They appreciated the water and didn't understand how dirty and polluted the waters were. Nowadays, I think we're all united in wanting to protect the Great Lakes. We're worried about invasive species, and we're all committed. And I think the Great Lakes for the state of Michigan is not a partisan issue. I think that everybody's going to work together to protect the Clean Water Act legislation as it has been passed. And then you've got to talk, I know the delegation's been united in trying to fight some of these invasive species that have been coming in. How do you close locks? How do you get money to fight zebra mussels? All of that. And I will very much be committed with the mission, if God willing, the people of Michigan joining the delegation and protecting our Great Lakes and all the different fronts that one's got to talk about.
Well, thank you. Okay.
I just have to say there's also, as I've discovered as a a person that believes in renewable energy as much as possible, even if it's going to cost us a little more initially. Canada, across Lake Huron, has, is it six or more nuclear reactors? A couple of them are now retired, if you will, but they have an initiative in Ontario to try to build underground, not underground, but pool storage
nuclear
of
the nuclear waste.
Yeah, and a lot of activists, even here in America, in Michigan, say these pools will just be far too close to Lake Huron, and it should be underground. It should be hundreds of miles away, so it won't leach into our water supply. That's tough when you have to work with another country on issues like that, of course. But you're obviously already aware of that issue.
I think my concern on this is, I actually wrote an op-ed and then I became a candidate, so it didn't go in. There's too many people in the state of Michigan don't know that there is a proposal to store radioactive waste underneath the Great Lakes, and that is just not a place that it should be. So I am very strongly opposed, and hope that we can educate the population of Michigan that there is this threat, so that we can all work very hard and very strongly against such a thing happening.
I think in 10 or 20 years, we may be a very important supply of fresh water for maybe half of this country. Mm-hmm. In fact, I don't know how we could resist some siphoning off if people are getting thirsty elsewhere. I know when I see a lot of companies bottling groundwater here in Michigan and making profits and paying almost nothing for the water, that seems wrong too, but that's probably a state issue and not a national one.
That is a state issue, but the fact of the matter is, the world is facing a water supply issue, so we all need to be talking about this, thinking about conservation and appreciating what we have as a natural resource in the state of Michigan, four of the Great Lakes bordering us.
Government spying, John.
Yes, government spying. Yeah, so the NSA and CIA, what's your feeling?
So I'm going to tell you that I am a real bugaboo about privacy. And I think the American people have no idea how everything that's happening in their life somebody has access to. And, you know, for a long time, I didn't have a Kroger card where I would get the discount with my number, because I didn't think it was anybody's business as to what brand I was buying at Kroger. Okay. And I think the American people, too many, have no idea that, you know, now with your credit card, there's nothing you can do. They know what brand of anything that you are buying, that with your cell phone, they can track wherever you are. The banks have access to your health care information. And I'm just somebody that thinks there's entirely too much information out there about everybody, and that we all need to be far more sensitive and aware of what kind of information about each of us is available to people. And we need to start to look at what the government's doing, but not only government, but how much other people have information on all of us. And I don't think it's all right. And privacy will be an issue that I am going to talk about, try to sensitize people to, and help them think about just the cookies that are there on their iPads or when they go to the internet, and who's being tracked. When you go and you buy something online, and now you go up on your Facebook page or you go on a Google search, how does it just pop up all of a sudden that what you've been shopping for, it gives you other options? I don't think that's anybody's business.
I'm with you 100% on that.
Yeah, I've always been an advocate of privacy, not because of anything to hide, but it's all my business, you know? If I want to share it, I will. And I know it's going to be terrible with the technology increasing as it is. It's going to be easier and easier for some kind of futuristic quantum computer, I think that's the term, to analyze and assess data so fast, or is it data? I had a fight with somebody here a couple days ago about that, it's going to be almost irresistible. I think that's one of the defenses they make. It's almost irresistible temptation that the technology provides this sort of not just access, but analysis that hey, if we don't do it first, maybe some foreign country will. But I don't think that's a necessary trade-off. I really don't. In the couple minutes we have left, we'd like you to do a summary. We're talking to Debbie Dingell here, candidate for 12th District U.S. Congress. And Highway 61, our blues show is coming up. Joanne has arrived to get her music set up. A lot of my listeners want to know your stand on women's reproductive rights. What about pro-choice or right to life?
I believe it's a very personal decision, and it's an individual's right to choose. We live in a country that has many freedoms. It's a very difficult issue for many people, but it's a individual's right to choose. And I don't believe that the government has a place in getting into such a very personal decision.
Our local representative to Lansing, George Duraney, he's a Catholic, as I believe you are.
I am
still
a Catholic.
Practicing Catholic, and he finds it a difficult problem. He's not in favor of abortion, but I think the idea is education, counseling, available options, giving people options. It's not either yes or no. There might be some other approaches to this. So he's had some difficult explanations and has some real challenges himself on voting on some of these issues that affect in Michigan. But the right to choose, I thought that's just like privacy. I thought that's one of the basic landmarks of our democracy.
I totally agree with you. I am a Catholic woman, and not only that, but I'm someone that wanted a child very badly and was unable to have one. And if I could encourage someone to put someone up for adoption, that I would do. But I believe that we should try to prevent women should have access to birth control if they want it. They should know what their options are. I am not going to tell any woman anything that they should do, period. Mm-hmm. What's right for them. It's a very individual in all aspects of it. I don't think I know anyone that is pro-abortion. It's the most difficult decision that a person ever has to make. But I think that they are, we're running out of time. So very hard, tough issue.
Yeah, I wish every candidate could have this opportunity of at least a half an hour, either on this show or all the other shows or more, to just handle the questions and the issues the way they prefer to explain them and get a chance to explain where they're coming from on them. Because I think just stating catchphrases isn't enough. But I'm going to give you a minute for a bunch of catchphrases, if you'd like to tell people why they should consider voting for you for the 12th District U.S. Congress on November 4th. And then also you could mention, the website, folks, is DebbieDingellForCongress.com. Okay, it's out there. A lot of information about her there. And a few of the places that you're going to be in the community, I know you're going to be many places, but maybe a couple of where we can find you in the next week.
Well, if you live in Dearborn, I must say this, you can find me at Panera most mornings. Michigan Avenue. I have a group of people that I have had. I do hot chocolate, they do coffee for years. And many of them are Tea Party members, and we have an honest discussion about what the issues are. And it's probably one of the most important things I do, because I want to know what people are thinking, what people are upset about. And that's who I am. I'm Debbie Dingell, who is from Dearborn, loves this community, will work very hard and fight for them. And when issues that they care about are being discussed in Washington, I think they should have a voice at the table that's going to represent them. And I'm going to work very hard to be their voice at the table about the issues that they care about. Manufacturing, autos, affordable education. Every American should be able to, if they're sick and need to go to the doctor, not have to think about whether they can afford to go to the doctor, whether they can afford to get treatment, choose between food or medicine. So that's why I'm running, because I care deeply about these subjects, and I want to work for the people of the 12th District, and I promise I will be their fighter, and I will always be accessible.
Thank you so much, Debbie Dingell, for being on the WHFR Journal today. And I just want to encourage, in summing up to all of our listeners, make the best choices. I think you should wait till the last minute rather than doing a ballot in advance. Get to see these candidates. They're still out and about. The